It's time to speak to Tony Gosling. Of course, Tony, former BBC reporter and investigative journalist of merit. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning.
Well, you know, I've been asking you, or you've been kind enough to intermittently make comment on my programme about what we've been seeing in Greece. And now that we're at the other side of the weekend and there's been a resounding no, what do you make of that?
Well, I think what's happening here, effectively, is that the Greeks, I mean, I'm talking about the people and the politicians that represent them, are taking on the central bankers of Europe and the International Monetary Fund, really for the rest of Europe. I mean, that's my reading of this. They're not seeing this just as a something where we're prepared to just go back to the drachma and do things on our own and sort of have Greek sovereignty with the Greeks inward looking and saying, well, never mind what happens in the rest of Europe. They're trying to steer the whole of Europe towards a much better, a more sustainable, sensible, helpful financial policy where the monetary, these unaccountable monetary bodies like the IMF and the European Central Bank actually work for the people rather than money is used really against the people as a weapon and against countries. I mean, this is the, I'm afraid, the habit of the IMF and these big organisations. I've been talking even really here about the Bank of England, etc., is that they see themselves as all-powerful and that they can use money to manipulate people, manipulate markets and actually even, you know, control whole economies. And they also put themselves in a position which is where we are actually more powerful than the politicians because we can, you know, influence the top echelons of political parties, we can harass and bully and that sort of thing. And that's, I'm afraid, the sort of despotic power that we've got nowadays, which seems to be quite influential and powerful in our politics. So the Greeks are saying, not just we're not happy about this happening in Greece. They're saying, well, we want to turn the whole of Europe around to make the bankers more accountable. And I think they've actually taken, it seems, I mean, it's quite resounding no vote yesterday. It sounds to me like they've taken the Greek people with them on this mission to not just sort Greece out and say, you know, stick two fingers up to the rest of Europe and say, well, we're actually going to go it alone now. That they want to move the policy of the whole of the, you know, hundreds of millions of people of Europe around.
But Tony, as we understand it, you know, or certainly we understand that the Greek people are fed up of austerity. They've said no to more austerity. You're going one step further and saying actually they've taken it upon themselves to actually fight the battle on behalf of all of the people of Europe.
I don't think they're going to fight the whole battle on their own, but I think that what they're doing is they're almost leading that fight.
And yet they've put themselves potentially in as volatile a situation or as uncertain a situation as they would be if they had voted for more austerity.
Well, I think that there are some contingencies over there, but then let's just also be aware that there are forces within Greece that are fighting the people and the government's democratic view. So there are a lot of people who, despite what the, you know, the government that was elected, Syriza, and the referendum yesterday, they're actually, you know, they're still fighting against that in what I would say is quite a sort of mean way, in a way that they're not accepting that as an answer. So I'm talking about institutions like the Bank of Greece, for example. I think it's pretty clear, my reading of this, looking sort of in between the lines and at some of the more obscure newspaper articles on this, is that the Greek government have been having a real hard time with the Bank of Greece, actually getting them to do what they're told, and the other big banks in Greece, also with some of the other political classes, and possibly, you know, particularly the announcement today about the resignation of Varoufakis, the finance minister, is also really interesting because he's basically been forced out. I mean, look at this whole situation, is that, you know, the Greeks have really voted for him, but he won't be able to do negotiations because the IMF have imposed a deal. They're saying, well, look, we can do a deal with Greece, but not with Varoufakis. Now, hang on a minute. Varoufakis is the guy that the Greek people have elected to do this deal, but you're saying you can't deal with him. Now, you can see there's something much more than just boring old democratic politics going on, and that there is a what seems like a a kind of oligarchical control that's saying, this guy we can't deal with, even though the Greek people have elected him to do it. Well, they're really showing their disdain for democracy by making that kind of demand. So, you know, this is a big fight that's going on here, and it's been going on for decades. And as I said last time I was on, I think, that, you know, we've got a whole situation of terrible, you know, dreadful conditions in many of the third world countries, in, you know, places like South America and Africa, etc., because of the way the IMF has been doing this over the years. And this is really the first time that it's happened, this kind of really draconian structural adjustment and possible collapse of a banking system within Europe and even within the EU Eurozone. So that's really what this is about. It's about bringing the sort of condition that have prevailed in Africa into Europe, and the people fighting back against it in Greece.
Well, what about the future without Varoufakis? Because he has been a huge part of stimulating the Greek people to vote no. Very intelligent man, a very amenable man, a man who really has the courage of his convictions. Can Tsipras continue without him?
Yes, of course he can. Now, look, I mean, I don't think Varoufakis would have stepped aside if he didn't think that someone else was around who could take over, who had his kind of intellect. Now, you know, the problem with him is not, you know, he'll now be acting, I would imagine, behind the scenes, but, you know, he's got the intelligence and the understanding of economics, which, let's face it, probably about 0.001% of the population really understand the inner workings of the IMF and you know, the various different possibilities. And I think a lot of fear is used, you know, fear of a banking collapse, what's going to happen. I mean, we had, for example, John Redwood here in Britain talking about how simple it is, actually, just to be prepared and ready to go back to your own currency on a Monday morning. So you make an announcement, maybe on a Friday evening, that your currency is changing from one currency to another. You may want to close the stock market on the first couple of days of the week after, but actually changing over currencies is a fairly easy thing to do. In fact, they did it in Greece, didn't they, when they went over to the euro. So, you know, there's a lot of fear put in here, saying, well, you know, and that fear really comes from the power that the creditors have over the debtor. That is to say, the power that the loan shark has over the poor person living on a council estate that can't pay their bills. So, you know, if you don't do as we say, we're going to come banging on the doors, we're going to get you evicted, all this kind of thing. So that's the sort of fear that they've been using.
Tsipras is adamant that Greece will continue to use the euro. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's because they want to bring Europe with them. And it's also because they want European project to work, and they want Greece to be part of it.
Is it possible that decision will be taken out of his hands?
Well, possibly, but they want to take it as far as they can, and they want to send a message to the whole of Europe that they're not happy, and actually hundreds of millions of people across Europe who have been suffering under this austerity programme, a ridiculous programme, effectively, which means that in order to boost the economy, what they're doing is they're taking public spending right back, and they're failing to borrow money, even though money is incredibly cheap to borrow at the moment. So it's almost like a kind of masochism going on by the banks all across Europe, and the Greeks are taking it on intellectually. They're saying, actually, this doesn't make sense. This is a kind of form of unnecessary punishment and pain, and we've had enough of it.
Let's move on, because we need to cover a couple of other things. Now, tomorrow sees the anniversary of the July the 7th bombing, London bombings.
Yeah.
And, of course, we're just less than 2 weeks since the largest terrorist atrocity committed against British people, that being the one in Tunisia. Let's start, first of all, with tomorrow's anniversary.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the things I do is, I mean, because I worked on terrorism for the BBC in London at Marylebone High Street and Greater London Radio years ago, I was doing reporting on the death of, for example, the death of the MP Ian Gow and the IRA bomb at the Stock Exchange. You know, we were really the first people, actually, even before the police, to report. I mean, when I was doing a report on the Stock Exchange bomb, our what we were doing was, and I actually put through the calls and was doing the research where we were reporting to London as the police were arriving at the scene, because we'd heard that there'd been this explosion, and so we got live commentary from a guy that was working at Royal Bank of Scotland who was looking out as the police were arriving and putting up the police tape at the scene. So we were the first sort of, you know, of any of the news media to be reporting on some of these events. And so I think I do know a bit about terrorist attacks. You know, I was working there at the time. And when the 7/7 thing happened, immediately I started bringing up, or, you know, what were popping up in front of me were all sorts of anomalies to do with the attack. So that is to say, things which simply did not fit with the official account we were being told. Now, I'm not in a position to run a public inquiry, but what I can do is I can look at, well, hang on, this doesn't fit, this doesn't fit, this seems to be a lie, etc. And the first thing I came across was the a report from Associated Press in Jerusalem that the Israeli embassy had received a warning before the attacks, and that as a result, Benjamin Netanyahu, who was in London at the time, he was the Israeli finance minister, hadn't left his hotel that morning because he was due to be at Liverpool Street for a conference at the same time the bomb went off. And it was reported that he didn't leave his hotel because they got a warning. Well, hang on, because there was no warning. This was a surprise attack. So it was like the first thing that made me think, hang on, something is a bit fishy here. Now, I've since found out that from another journalist that the Israeli embassy actually reported that they went on to lockdown that morning, heightened state of security, between 6 and 7 a.m., where there's the first bomb actually exploded around about 9 a.m. So, hang on, if they've got that amount of warning, why aren't they sharing it, number one, with the rest of London? You know, and then why are they lying, saying after the event that they didn't get a warning? Because they've since denied it. So there's loads of stuff, and I put together a program last Friday where we went through 13 different anomalies, serious anomalies. Another one I'll put to you now is the other end of this, really, which is the alleged bombers themselves who came from Leeds. Two of them, Shahzad Tanweer and Mohammed Siddiqui Khan, were actually trained in terrorist techniques by a former Special Boat Service soldier called Martin McDade. Now, he was working with them at something called the ICRA Bookshop in Leeds, and he was actually taking them to terrorist training camp he was running in Cumbria. But he's a former British Special Forces soldier, and yet I've never seen him be arrested and interviewed about his involvement in the 7/7 attacks. So there's, another major, major problem is the complete lack of any kind of CCTV pictures of the alleged bombers on the tube trains, the three tube trains or the bus. And I've spoken to a guy called Daniel Obachiki who says he was on the bus and that he didn't believe that the bomber was actually on there. So none of this has been properly looked at. All there's been is, of course, there's no trial because the four bombers were dead. And all there's been is this appalling inquest by Lady Justice Hallett in 2010, which has absolutely disgusted many of the victims' families because none of their questions were answered at this inquest. And anyway, an inquest is designed for a single suspicious death, not for 52 suspicious deaths. And also, she held her inquest without a jury. So there's just a litany of horrific anomalies here. And of course, there's been no closure for those who were either directly involved, or many of them anyway, or their families.
And why now? Why are they talking about this in the mainstream media now, Tony?
Why are they talking about it, or why are they not?
About the one of the perpetrators having been in Israel and so on. Why is because it's the day before the anniversary? What's the connection?
Well, obviously, there's everyone's looking at this more closely because it's 10 years down the line. But I don't think there's been any proper documentary investigation, that sort of thing. I mean, there was, back in December 2005, there was a very good internet documentary called Ludicrous Diversion, which was made, and the title of that was based on Tony Blair, who was Prime Minister at the time. He said a public inquiry into the attacks would be a ludicrous diversion because he said, oh, well, we already know what happened, so there's no need to have a public inquiry.
Quite insulting to the victims of that.
Of course it is, especially since that's what they're calling for. Now, they have now slightly changed their tune, the victims' families, and they're saying that they want an independent Hillsborough-style inquiry, which I think is very sensible, because the way that the public inquiries work now is rather than being managed by a member of the judiciary, although they do obviously have a judge involved, we're talking about the Hutton inquiry style thing or the Leveson inquiry, that kind of thing. They're now managed by government ministers. They're not managed by the judiciary, independent of government. So, you know, they're really not worth having. You know, this is the trouble. Is what they've done is they've, you know, almost completely changed the system by which public inquiries happen. So an independent Hillsborough-style inquiry run by the people who were the victims, or families of the victims, is really the only way forward for them. And, you know, there are many people that I've seen or spoken to who have just had enough of the stonewalling because it's been so painful. But, of course, the big story, really, in a way, at this 10th anniversary is the total failure of the mainstream media to really put some of these points. And we did on Friday. We had a go with 13 major problems that there are with the official story of the attacks. And so we've done a little bit of investigative journalism on a shoestring budget, but that's about all you can do. I mean, another major problem with the official story is that there's a French anti-terrorism expert, Christophe Chabot, who was in London at the time of the attacks, and he said the tube train bombs were so powerful they were almost certainly C4 military explosives, not the type of explosives made up in a bath, this TATP stuff we're told that the rucksack bombers used. There's also Peter Powers' terror drills. This chap was doing terror drills on the same day at the same three tube stations, he says, on lots of TV programs that week. He said the same three tube stations where it actually happened. Now, those drills were, he's now since a long time since the bombings, he said that they were organized by this group called Reed Elsevier. Now, Reed Elsevier is a publisher that also happens to be the organizer of the biggest arms fair in Britain. So they're very, very close to the big arms firms and the arms industry. You know, so there's just a whole list, and I would encourage people, if they want to know more, to go online to our thisweek.org.uk and have a listen to our sort of, we did a sort of 30 minutes of investigation. But I think one of the most damning things, you know, for me is the fact that we've got, you know, the alleged bombers being trained by Special Boat Service, you know, Royal Navy Special Forces. I mean, this is absolutely disgusting and unbelievable and really needs to be fished out by the mainstream press, you know, and then we can start getting to the bottom of it. And the real victims, of course, are still waiting, like the Hillsborough victims were, for 25 years to find out what really happened 10 years after those attacks.
That's disgraceful. And, Tony, quickly, let's move to Tunisia before I have to let you go.
Yeah, well, okay, these attacks last week, that's Friday, wasn't it, the week before, we've had quite a good look at that as well on our investigation section on our radio programme we do here in Bristol. And it's quite clear that we were initially told there was one attacker. There's also people arriving on jet skis, and other attackers. And it's only really because there was a very high-profile blogger, journalist and advisor to the Scottish National Party whose niece was actually one of the people who was injured in the attacks, it seems, that's the only reason that the truth has got out. Because obviously, you know, if you're someone that doesn't have those sorts of connections and you're involved in the attacks, you haven't necessarily got a way you can just pick up the phone and get straight through in the attention of a national newspaper editor. And that's Craig Murray. He's the former ambassador to Uzbekistan. And he put some stuff on his blog, which has since been used all over the world, including in the Daily Mail, saying, well, actually, that, you know, the what was going on in Tunisia wasn't as it was being reported. There were all sorts of, again, anomalies. Now, isn't it convenient as well that all of a sudden all the fingers are being pointed at Syria, saying, oh, well, we've got to start bombing Syria. We've got to start intervening in Syria. Now, hang on a minute, because if you're going to start, I mean, we've already had the Ghouta weapons attack a couple of years ago, chemical weapons, which was initially blamed on the Assad government, which the United Nations and Seymour Hersh, the American journalist, have both proved was actually the rebels who we were supporting doing this chemical weapons attack, and that was blocked. So, you know, there was no attack on invasion of Syria at the time. It was blocked by the Labour Party in the British Parliament a couple couple of years ago. And yet now we're being told this is another reason why we've got to actually intervene in Syria. Now, you can't do that, yeah? First of all, you've got to go to Parliament. You've got to have a proper discussion, a proper debate, and you've got to vote on it. And secondly, and actually more importantly, you've then got to go to the United Nations Security Council and say, we now intend to violate Syrian airspace and bomb Syria. And you've got to get the Chinese and the Russians to agree to you, otherwise they're going to veto your resolution. Now, they seem to be trying to go right round this and send the RAF into Syria. Now, I would suggest the RAF are not going to go into Syria because, actually, the Syrians have got a very good air defence system supplied to them by the Russians. So if we send our Typhoon jets or Tornado jets or whatever over into Syria, the most probable thing that's going to happen to them before they ever going to have a chance to have a go at ISIS is they're going to get shot down by the Syrians. So we're starting to get into a really dangerous game here where it looks like there's all sorts of the terrible deaths of the people in Tunisia is being used as just another excuse to try and intervene in a foreign country. And actually, you know, we've intervened in Iraq. Has that made any Iraq any better for people Iraqis to live in? No, it hasn't. So maybe we should just get our nose out of Syria once and for all.
Tony Gosling, we're out of time, but very, very thought-provoking as always. Thanks a lot for your time today.
Thank you, Pippa.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Europe Today brings this hugely diverse continent together.
Stephen Ritson.
A measured, sensible debate would be a very good thing.
The stories that affect the lives of Europeans.
Monday to Friday at midday on Talk Radio Europe.
Europe Today.